distinguished guests. I have attended many feasts, but never have I so enjoyed a dinner. Never have I so enjoyed a dinner, nor have I heard played better the music that I love outside America. I move a vote of thanks to one and all whose efforts made this possible. No one who heard could but admire your eloquent remarks from near, and millions more hear what we say through satellite technology than ever heard a public speech before. No one is out of touch. No one, no one, no one is out of touch. Telecommunication has broadcast your message into space. Yet soon our words won't be recalled, while what we do can change the world. We have at times been enemies. We still have differences, God knows. But let us, in these next 5 days, start a long march on new highways, in different lanes, but parallel, and heading for a single goal. The world watches and listens. We must seize the earth. 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 And seize the day.
Thank you. The end of the first act of Nixon in China, the opera by John Adams, conducted by the composer here at the BBC Proms. And those cheers you just heard were for John Adams bowing to the promenaders. It's like a dream, sings President Richard Nixon. And to many witnessing the Nixon's visit to China in 1972, it must have seemed that way. Well, you just heard Robert Orth and Jessica Rivera as Richard and Pat Nixon, Gerald Finley as Premier Zhou Enlai, Alan Oke as Chairman Mao, and James Rutherford as Henry Kissinger with the BBC Singers and BBC Symphony Orchestra. We'll be back for Act Two, Mrs. Nixon's sightseeing trip, and Madam Mao introducing her idea of Chinese culture to a global audience after the first of this evening's two intervals. Well, earlier this evening, Louise Fryer was joined at the Royal College of Music for tonight's Proms Plus by Chinese writer and filmmaker Sun Shuyun and Professor of the History and Politics of Modern China at Oxford University, Rana Mitter.
Many thanks for joining me. Now, I had the chance to talk very briefly last night to John Adams, and he was talking about growing up in New Hampshire. He went to school in Concord, which is a city he describes as the nerve centre of the presidential primaries that take place every 4 years. He shook JFK's hand the night before Kennedy won the New Hampshire primary in 1960. He cast his first vote for Senator Eugene McCarthy, not to be confused with the other McCarthy. He was a Democrat who, in the late 60s, campaigned against the Vietnam War. John Adams blames Nixon for trying to send him to Vietnam. He managed to avoid the draft, although he wasn't able to tell me how he managed to evade it. So we're going to be discussing historical events, but they're events that are very personal to the composer. The opera itself is driven by the personalities of the key players. On the American side, Nixon, his national security advisor, Henry Kissinger, and Nixon's wife, Pat. And on the Chinese side, the Premier, Zhou Enlai, Madam Mao, and of course, Mao himself. Shuyun, you were a child in China at the time of the meeting in 1972. I wonder if you could start by telling us what kind of a man Mao was.
I think the first thing you learned in Chinese school is long live Chairman Mao for 10,000 years. And it was drilled into us that he was the savior, because without him, there would have been no new China. You see his portraits, the benevolent, smiling portraits that was everywhere, at home, in school, even today still on Tiananmen Square. I think you would say that he embodied Chinese, young Chinese men of the 20th century, a man who saw the old China collapsing in front of their eyes, and then the country torn apart, but all the warlords and the different new ideas, you know, begin to compete for a voice in China.
So turning to his opposite number, what was Nixon like?
Nixon, I think, is one of the most intriguing political characters of the 20th century. I mean, I will freely confess I've been slightly obsessed by him for a very long time, as those who've worked with me on history will know. I love the description that one of President Eisenhower's secretaries had of him, and he was, of course, vice president under Eisenhower before he became president a few years later. And she said, "He doesn't seem so much like a nice man as a man playing a nice man." And I think that gets to the darkness at the heart of Nixon. He tried so hard in his life. He came from a relatively poor background, and something about that created this sort of rage within him, the need to do better than the rich people he saw around him. I mean, he was obsessed with the Kennedys, you know, these kind of suave characters who sailed off Cape Cod and seemed effortlessly to move up in American society. Actually, the Kennedys, of course, had quite a hardscrabble life at the beginning too, but Nixon really was angry and resented their presence in public life, and yet in a strange way tried to model himself on them as well. So really a kind of bundle of contradictions sitting at the heart of American politics, and of course trying to achieve greatness, which is what the China visit was all about.
He was quite paranoid as well, wasn't he?
Yes, Richard Hofstadter came up with this line that there was a paranoid style in American politics, and the description could really have been made entirely for Richard Milhouse Nixon. He had a list of friends and a list of enemies, and let's just say that the enemies list was rather longer than the friends list, including most of the prayers.
But I think that's why when Mao first met Nixon, he immediately saw in this man a soulmate, somebody he could identify with. Ruthlessness, this kind of paranoid, because then, you know, later on he told Heath, there is a man who knows what he stands for and what he wants, and above all, the strength of the mind to get it.
So that's,
high praise.
That's what Mao made of Nixon. Let's have a listen to what Nixon made of Mao.
Mao Zedong was a unique man in a generation of great revolutionary leaders. He was a totally dedicated and pragmatic communist. But he was also a visionary poet, deeply steeped in the history of the Chinese people. Some years ago, he wrote a poem that began, "We had much to do, and quickly. The sky earth spins, and time is short. 10,000 years is long, and so a morning and an evening count." Historians will assess Mao Zedong's career and its impact on the Chinese people in the world. There can be no doubt that he made his morning and his evening count in working for the vision he saw and for the principles in which he so strongly believed.
That was Nixon on his impressions of Chairman Mao after the death of Mao was announced in 1976. Well, the man who in many ways made Mao's vision a reality was his premier, Zhou Enlai. He was, again, a very smooth operator, wasn't he? A consummate diplomat.
I think he's a great man, and more than a diplomat, because there you have the quintessential Mandarin official, the classic Chinese scholar who turned into a politician or diplomat. And he had both the talent and the skill, and I think also the patience. So he was the ideal assistant to Mao.
I have to say, I think this does cover over some of the things that perhaps have been discovered more recently, which is that at the same time as his urbane cosmopolitanism can't be denied, it's also known that he was a pretty ruthless operator. I mean, in his early communist career, he'd been responsible for liquidating a great many colleagues. And even during the Cultural Revolution, there's a telling line from the writer James Palmer that perhaps he saved more monuments than people. So there's a darkness even to Zhou Enlai, but certainly the outward-looking Mandarin urbane face was something that Westerners gratefully latched onto. They felt they could recognize a sort of fellow kind of official in that sense.
Why had relations between China and America become so difficult? What was it that caused the rift?
I think there is something very simple. Fundamentally, America lost China in 1949. Its support during the Second World War, or before that, it supported the old nationalist government, which is now in Taiwan. And in the Civil War, it chose to back the nationalist. And as a result, you know, when 1949 came, there's only one way for them to go.
It was Henry Kissinger, wasn't it, who wanted to reverse that and to seek a thaw in relations. You have both met Kissinger. I don't know who to ask first
Not
about what he
time.
Was like. Rana, tell me about Kissinger.
Well, I actually had the experience of interviewing Henry Kissinger last year for Night Waves here on Radio 3, and it was, of course, an immensely exciting experience because whatever you think of him, it's a little bit like interviewing a piece of history, certainly in this case. I think it's fair to say that Kissinger was very heavily involved with the detail. In a sense, he's the opposite number to Zhou Enlai, both in terms of the reality of the diplomacy and the way the opera, of course, is put together. But I think one shouldn't underestimate that Nixon did make the first move. It was very much a Nixon policy. That said, in some ways, Kissinger, because of the kind of mind he had, has indeed, was perhaps the right person to undertake this sort of task, because it involved lots of cloak and dagger activity, which one imagines he really loved, you know, flying secretly under the radar, literally, into Beijing and doing the Sherpa work, the preliminary negotiations. And also in his case, trying to figure out the Chinese mind. In his memoirs, there are lots of statements about how any of the Chinese official pronouncements had to be understood like the inner courtyards of the Forbidden Forbidden City, one courtyard inside another, inside another, inside another. I have to say that the Chinese sources that we now have from the other side suggest that at least some of the Chinese were saying slightly ruder things about the Americans, saying that they, at least that some of them appeared to have only quite recently lost their tails and come out of the trees. Not Kissinger, I think, but perhaps some of his followers.
Now, what were the political reasons for wanting to extend a hand to China?
Well, the opening to China came actually at a very dangerous moment in the Cold War. I mean, many people can still remember back to a time in the 60s when the Soviets and the Chinese looked as if they might actually be going to war with each other. These two communist giants had fallen out with each other a few years previously and were, you know, both nuclear armed and potentially about to go to war. In addition, the United States was bogged down in Vietnam. This was a situation where Nixon thought that by making this dramatic, almost George Orwell 1984 type move of making friends with one of the communist powers, he could turn the tables within the Cold War. And indeed, that was the reason that essentially the visit to China really changed the orientation of the whole of the rest of that period. It was a dramatic geopolitical move.
It was a pretty risky move too, wasn't it? Because he wasn't actually sure that Mao would meet him.
That's absolutely right. The Chinese gave all these assurances, which were very polite but somewhat vague, that if the President of the United States turned up, then important meetings would be held. But they never actually said that Mao was going to show up. And in practice, they only met once, Nixon and Mao, during that trip. It was enough. But even then, the conversation was actually pretty vague. Nixon kept trying to bring up specifics, Taiwan, Vietnam, whole variety of geopolitical issues. And Mao kept talking in vague terms, saying, no, we're not going to talk about politics, we'll talk about philosophy.
China was really desperate. I think we were in a really also very dangerous position. I think that's why this event could have took place. If it were just because of America, then China was not willing. I don't think it would have happened. But we were so isolated. You know, we had a war with America in Korea and a proxy war in Vietnam, and we had a war with India on the Western Front. Then in 1969, we had a war with Russia. So literally, you were surrounded by enemies, and there's no way that even Mao, whose slogan was to make China the vanguard of world communist victory, could see it's not working. And it was something they had to, and he got four old generals to advise him, and they all said, you need to look west.
And that desperation does turn up, particularly, I think, in the third act of the opera, which, of course, involves the reproduction of a Cultural Revolution-style model opera, because it reflects the fact that Mao's wife was not by any means as keen on the idea of welcoming the president of the great imperialist country in the way that her husband eventually was. And the violence of those views and of the society which had sort of produced the situation, I think, is very audible in the way that Adams has orchestrated that part of the opera.
It's very interesting, isn't it? There are two main roles for women, and they're so contrasted. Pat Nixon and Madame Mao. I don't think you could get women who are kind of more poles apart, really. I mean, tell me a little bit about Pat Nixon. She turned up stepping out of the plane wearing a scarlet red coat, even though she'd been primed that only prostitutes in China wore red. Was she politically naive?
Well, yeah, this has been said, but actually, you know, she wasn't politically naive. She's actually perfectly within her rights, because I'll ask you to confirm, so I haven't got it wrong. But actually, they were basically advised by people whose ideas of China were extremely out of date. It must have been blatantly obvious that in a country which was nicknamed Red China, red was hardly going to be a colour that would be politically offensive in that sense. Pat Nixon, I think, in a sense, is, I mean, again, an interesting character, and in a sense is given more form by the opera than perhaps she had in real life. People felt she was a little neglected, perhaps, by Nixon in her later years. But, of course, there's that great line, I come from a poor family, trivial things are not for me. And that, I think, sums up the way in which she's made part of the enterprise that Nixon is given in the opera. I mean, when Alice Goodman was asked to write the libretto, she said, yes, but I write it as a heroic opera, not as a satire. And one of the things that, well, for many people would seem very surprising is that watching it makes you feel very sympathetic to all of the main characters, and that includes both of the Nixons.
How was Pat Nixon received in China?
I think it's, looking back, people, of course, saw her as the human face of the whole visit. She went to visit a commune where she, played with children. She, you know, had the good time in the opera. But I think, or the Forbidden City, of course, but I think it was Madame Mao, Jiang Qing, I think, who took the center stage, because we were talking about in the second act, where they went to see the opera, actually produced by Mao's wife, these revolutionary women who were born from a very poor family, liberated and joined the communists and then fought for the whole country. And that was the opera, a dozen operas. We, I think, not just I, but the whole of the Chinese had to watch for about 20 years, nothing else to watch but that. But I think also, I think people perhaps were unfair to Jiang Qing. And she was the scapegoat, of course, after Mao's death, for have plotted against a lot of things, for opposed Zhou Enlai. But I think she was a very, very wise woman, probably frustrated because Mao had so many women, and Jiang Qing wasn't even allowed to see him. And this ambitious woman, beautiful, clever, what did she do? She started to have her own power politics. And that she turned into producing this opera, which a lot of people say, okay, it was boring, it's revolutionary. But when you look at it, it was beautiful.
So do you think she's been dealt a poor hand in history? Do you think she deserves to be reconsidered?
You know, there is only one woman in our history which was made an emperor. That was it. Or empress in the 7th century, the most open cosmopolitan age in Chinese history. And she died, she had the tomb, grand, but with nothing on the stone study. She said, man would write history. I would leave posterity to judge. I think perhaps it's too early to judge Jiang Qing when we had no, you know, not enough evidence anyway.
So how does the ballet in the opera, in John Adams' opera, epitomize the role of women and the role of arts in China? I mean, Mao talked about the arts as being the cogs and screws of the revolutionary machine.
Absolutely. I think when you, whatever one says about a communist rule in China, I think one thing is certain. The status of women has just, you know, improved dramatically. It would be the difference of heaven and hell. I think, you know, for my grandma's generation with bound feet, for mom's generation who was simply, you know, part of the male society, and for my generation, which we are called Ha for the Sky. I think that huge transformation in barely 50 years is extraordinary. But talking about art, I think this is where communism does use art tremendously successful as a propaganda skill. And that, whether the opera is, you know, was watched by 100 million people, but the message was delivered and just sort of instilled in people's mind through all kinds of art.
Now, Nixon famously described the visit as the week that changed the world. Did it?
Well, it was certainly the week that helped him to get re-elected, although that probably wasn't in doubt at that point. I think, taking account for the fact that Nixon, rather like Mao, loved a bit of bombast, there's a lot of truth to it. Because if you look back from 40 years distance, which is what it is now, to that week and a little bit more than that, in February 1972, and all the other things that were going on around at that time, the Vietnam War, disturbances in Latin America, riots within America itself, there's an awful lot of bleakness there. This is one of the few events that, for good or ill, seems to stand the test of time. By going to China, by beginning the process that opened up full diplomatic relations between the world's most populous country and the world's most powerful and richest country, a dynamic was started that essentially has led us to where we are today, a world in which that very poor communist country is now technically still under a communist government, but in fact one of the most capitalist countries in the world in terms of its economy. It's got the second largest economy in the world, and it's in all of our lives in a way that was unimaginable unimaginable even a few years ago. You can't put all of that down to Nixon, but it is fair to give a certain amount of credit to the fact that he opened those doors that have then led us to the economic and geopolitical world that we see before us today. This very morning, after all, Hillary Clinton is in Beijing and talking to the Chinese very much as an equal partner, or at least equal interlocutor. And that also is the legacy of February 1972.
And how is the legacy seen in China?
I think it is a crucial. This is one of the turning points in history. It ended China's isolation. It's the importance of this country was recognized. But I think above all, for ordinary Chinese people, it planted the seeds of the open door policy, the reform that have transformed China, that have made the world look anew at China. I think that is, the point where it all happened.
For you, life must have changed dramatically in China. You still spend many months a year there. How has it evolved in your lifetime?
I think it's it is unbelievable, because when I look back, it's barely 40 years ago. And that was the country when China was on the verge of starvation, when Nixon visited China, when all the universities were shut down, and when, you look and there was, nothing there for people to live for, except for this ideology, communism. And we have come a long way. Of course, China is now recognized as one of the big players on the international stage. But we have a long way to go, not the least that 150 million Chinese still live in poverty. I think, but it is in the right direction.
Thank you. Incidentally, I asked John Adams yesterday about his opinion of Nixon, and he said he hated him. But on the other hand, he was pretty grateful to him too. A big thank you to my guests, Rana Mitter and Sun Shuyan.
Louise Fryer was chairing that Proms Plus discussion over at the Royal College of Music, and it was produced by Ruth Thompson. This is BBC Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms, and in the second interval in this evening's performance of Nixon in China, Adrian Morby will be examining the way tastes in subject matter for operatic plots have changed over the centuries, leading to the kind of docu-opera that the team of composer John Adams, librettist Alice Goodman and director Peter Sellers pioneered with Nixon in China back in 1987. Well, here's the story so far. The American president has landed in Peking, as Beijing still was in the early 70s. Nixon and Kissinger have had an audience with Chairman Mao, and we've witnessed the euphoria surrounding the official welcoming banquet. The opera's second act is where the action shifts really from documentary to allegory. The First Lady, Pat Nixon, sets off on her own on an official sightseeing trip in snowbound Peking. The First Lady is given a relentlessly positive and upbeat view of modern China. She's presented with a glass elephant, which brings back memories. And next comes the Evergreen People's Commune, where the guides distract her from the painful sight of the People's Clinic, persuading her to pose with the pigs for the photographers. She meets some children and reminisces about her days as a teacher. Then there's a visit to the Summer Palace, where Pat hopes for peace, progress and reconciliation, and a muted trumpet underpins her homily on the unknown soldier rising from his tomb. The final destination, the Ming tombs, where ancient Chinese emperors were laid to rest. And another elephant, this time a sandstone sculpture in the warm glow of the evening sun. But the words of the chorus hint at the terrors and deprivation of the Cultural Revolution. And as the sun sinks, it's time to return to the official limousine. Well, Mrs. Nixon's homespun simplicity could seem comic, but she actually comes over as a warmly sympathetic character. In fact, every main character is drawn with a degree of sympathy, except perhaps for Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, who's depicted as a true villain in the opera's next scene. The formidable Madam Mao, sung by Kathleen Kim, the former actress at Jiangqing, makes her first appearance. She's presiding over the performance the Nixons really were taken to see on their visit in 1972, The Red Detachment of Women. It was one of only two ballets officially sanctioned during the Cultural Revolution, part of Madame Mao's concept of a new genre of people's art. Suddenly, Pat Nixon notices that the brutal overseer who's beating a peasant's daughter on stage bears a startling resemblance to Henry Kissinger. In fact, for the purposes of the opera, it is him. And as the score increases in savagery at this point, whipping up rain, wind and a storm, the Nixons go to the aid of the heroine, enraging Madame Mao as she struggles to bring her propaganda piece to a suitable conclusion. Cue the jaunty entry of the Red Women's Militia and the chorus brandishing copies of Mao's Little Red Book, the famous volume of the chairman's quotations. Madame Mao's will has been reimposed and counter-revolutionary elements are silenced. Well, despite the limitations of performing Nixon in China at the Royal Albert Hall, you might fairly describe it as semi-staged. Chinese and American flags hang in various places. We've had the flags waved. Images of Mao and Nixon are being projected onto the screen that wraps around the top edge of the stage, and the cast is acting its socks off where it can. There's dancing to come as well. We had a little bit at the banquet. And the presidential aircraft really did make an entrance, albeit on a scale a little different to that imagined by the opera's creators, I suspect. A model of the very aircraft, Spirit of 76, passed from hand to hand amongst the members of the chorus and finally across to President Nixon, who handed it to Zhou Enlai as a sort of gift with the American entourage. You might have heard the delighted reaction to that in the hall and to the appearance of the Nixons. Robert Orth, eerily like former President Nixon, sort of jowly, long of jaw, hair slicked back and brilliantined, and the suit spot on as well. And he's got the gestures and that very toothy grin absolutely off to a T. Well, here comes composer John Adams to conduct the cast, the BBC Singers and BBC Symphony Orchestra, in the second act of Nixon in China. And in a snowbound Peking, Pat Nixon is about to embark on her official tour of the city.
Treat each day like Christmas.
Look down. Let passers-by look.